Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking about the latest films from the Coen brothers and Wes Anderson.
What's wrong with you?
Let me think about that.
Let me ask you something. What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
Look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything. Just call it.
Yeah, this is Robert Davis, and that was a little bit from No Country for Old Men, the new film by the Coen brothers. We're going to be talking about that today, and also the Darjeeling Limited by Wes Anderson. Both of these movies are in theaters now, and they're showing up on a few people's year-end lists of the best films of the year. We'll tell you whether we think those movies would belong on our lists in a few minutes. But first, I want to give the answer to the puzzler from last time. If you remember the last podcast, we said, name every person you can think of who has all 10 of the following traits. Number one, maybe I won't go down... I won't read all 10. You can just listen to the previous podcast if you want to know those. So here are the answers in no particular order. Brian De Palma, Denzel Washington, Joel Coen, not Ethan. He doesn't meet trait number 3. Usman Sembin, Jean Eustache, Holly Hunter, not Frances McDormand, as a lot of people said. I mean, if you think about trait number 7, should be pretty obvious. Lindsay Lohan, Joe Dante, Melvin Van Peebles, Claudette Colbert. Some people said Stephen Colbert, but of course that doesn't make any sense. Satyajit Ray, Italo Calvino, and Kevin Federline. So congratulations to everyone who got that correct. We didn't actually receive any correct entries, so those of you who got it correct must have kept the answers to yourselves. Congratulations anyway, and maybe we'll try to come up with easier puzzlers next time. Joining me today to talk about these new films, someone who meets 7 of the 10 traits, J. Robert Parks. Hey, J. Robert.
Hey, Rob. How are you?
It's been a long time since I looked forward to seeing a Coen Brothers film, but there was a time when I looked forward to seeing one, and I look back on those days fondly, and so I was really hoping that this would reignite my interest in the Coens. And I think the first hour did, and then after that, I'm not so sure. I may have ended neutral.
We'll have to save that discussion for a different podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
All right. We want to thank you for joining us for this episode of the Errata Movie Podcast. Sorry we didn't have time to get to that Wes Anderson film. You know, we should have just dropped the puzzler. Yeah, that would have been good. Hold on, wait a second. Something doesn't seem right here. We didn't even get J. Robert's opinion. Something's not... Oh, man. I can't believe this. My wife got me this Braille watch for my birthday, and it's really great for watching movies because I don't even have to, you know, look away from the screen to find out what time it is. I don't have to light up anything annoying in the theater, you know? It's a great way to find out what time it is, but I was sitting next to this asshole eating popcorn. Sorry, excuse me. This fucker sitting next to me eating popcorn jabs me with his elbow, and my finger skittered across the face of my watch. I didn't even think about it. The time is totally off. I knew something was weird. All right, so we've really given these movies short shrift. This isn't right. Let's go back. Let's get J. Robert. I don't care what time it is. Let's wake him up. And let's do this properly. Let's rewind. Sorry about that.
Sound okay? All right. You're recording already? Okay. You saw the new Coen Brothers film, No Country for Old Men in New York, and I think you said that it was the first hour you thought was terrific, and then maybe not so much on the last hour.
Yeah, I think the first hour was good as technique, you know, as a genre, very bloody well, I don't know about bloody, but violent film. And but the way it held me in suspense was pretty cool. If I can say that these things are cool, you know, it was very well done, and the pacing was good, and it was slow and deliberate and heading forward. I didn't feel like I was going to take away much from the movie or remember much about it or care even to see it again, but I liked the experience up to that point. And then I just felt like, I don't know, somehow I became gradually disengaged. I think when it lost that rhythm or lost, I think it detaches a little bit from this sort of genre suspense. And maybe that was an attempt to be a greater movie, a better movie. But strangely enough, that's where it lost me, because I think it was a good movie as a simpler movie, if that makes some sense.
Let me, just for people obviously who haven't seen the film, it's a Western, but it's a very contemporary Western. And it's about this bag of money that is a man played by Josh Brolin comes upon the aftermath of a shootout over drugs. And in fact, the drugs are still in the pickup truck, but there's no money around. And so he senses, there must be money somewhere. And so he sort of follows this trail of blood. And there's many trails of blood in this movie, to this dying man, and then he takes the money. Well, obviously, when you have, what is it, $2 million, I think? When you have $2 million, someone is going to want to get that money back. In that case, that man is played by Javier Bardem, who is basically evil personified, you know, this sort of this driving force who just will stop at nothing to get this $2 million. And so the movie, particularly for the first, hour and 15 minutes, is Josh Brolin trying to figure out how he's going to get away, and Javier Bardem, you know, slowly but surely closing in on him. And then, in what I think is a really interesting twist, the movie, and I won't give this away for people who are going to see it, but it shifts its perspective, and it shifts who it's about. And so I'm curious, is it when that shift takes place that you found yourself being disengaged?
Yeah, I think so. I think that what I loved, I guess I could say, about that first hour is the logic. It's very careful and methodical, just like these two characters are. You know, it's a cat and mouse. One is pursuing the other. And so we notice every little detail. We notice how they left things. We notice what door was open or where someone put a container of something, you know. Yeah. We notice all these little things, and the movie assumes that we're noticing these things and doesn't bother to explain each and every little detail, but lets us follow each one of those. And that's what was fun about it. It wasn't really anything beyond that that was fun. So it was a very simple pleasure. Mm-hmm. And you're right, it does shift. And before that, Tommy Lee Jones had been a small character in the movie, and I liked his small character, and it's very similar to a character he's played in. Yeah, maybe it's his standard character, in fact. But I like
he's a small town sheriff.
Yeah, a small town sheriff, and he's plain spoken and, you know, pithy statements. But he's I like that. People like that about him, and I'm one of them. And so I liked seeing him do that. But I think you're right that it was at that shift that it lost me.
For me, I like the film quite a bit more than you. I think it's a really strong work. It's one of my favorite Coen Brothers films, and I'm not a huge fan of theirs. But one of the things I like about this movie is that a lot of their other films I can admire, but they're always undermined a bit by the tone, particularly the snarkiness that the Coen Brothers often have, a not-so-subtle contempt for some of their characters. Whereas here, it felt much more straight in that way. This is a cops and robbers movie, sort of, or it's a cops and robber and other robber movie. And I was really sort of impressed by how it constructs this story. And so for me, when this shift occurs, I actually kind of liked that, just because it was like, oh, this is going in a different direction than I expected it to. And that element of surprise, you know, you assume you're heading towards this climactic showdown, and then suddenly you're not. And so then now I was even more curious to find out where we were going to go and where we were going to end up. And so in that sense, I kind of appreciated the movie. I wouldn't say that I was emotionally engaged, but I found myself enjoying it more and more as it went on.
Had you read the book?
No, I've no, I haven't. I've only read one Cormac McCarthy book. You haven't read the book either.
No, I haven't. I think you're right about the tone of the movie being different from other Coen Brothers movies. It almost doesn't. I think it probably most closely resembles Fargo. But I think you're right that it doesn't have that sort of. They often, I feel like, poke fun at people from the South, and you know, Raising Arizona is funny. Yeah, but it does start to seem like after a while that's their shtick, and I didn't see that here. I agree with you.
Not at all. And
I didn't miss it. So
I felt the same. So now we don't want to give away too much of the ending, but. The ending is at least caught me by surprise as to when it ends, and I didn't know what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah,
or did you not care by that point?
Yeah, I think I don't. Yeah, I don't think I was thinking much about it by then. I was surprised by that too, just because I still expected it to come back around to the genre, and you know have a punch at the end or something.
No, and it takes a completely different. Tack as to how it wants to end.
Yeah.
For me, and this is a very personal thing, so it's not going to be necessarily something that will translate to many people, but it becomes metaphysical, I think, at the end, as Tommy Lee Jones reflects on what he can and can't do as a sheriff, and what his and the nature of good and evil, and so there's this reflection upon that, and then also he talks about this dream that he has, and I don't know, I just found it really thought-provoking. It was one of those things that really grabbed me, and I've been thinking about it a lot in the couple of weeks since I saw it. So,
you know, maybe there's an interesting comparison to Million Dollar Baby, the Clint Eastwood film, which I think also I felt like I was with it as a genre movie, and then it switches to become something admittedly more serious, and it lost me at that point. And I'm not exactly, this may be a problem with my own way of viewing these movies, because I often like movies that have sudden shifts where you can compare the parts to each other. Stanley Kubrick did this a lot. 2001 is up there in my all-time favorites, and it does that multiple times. But for some reason, when Clint Eastwood did it, I didn't believe it. I didn't understand why bother with setting up this beginning with such simple pleasures and going something very different. And I think I felt the same way about this Coen Brothers movie. And it may just be that I went in wanting something different, and the movie was feeding that to me for a while, and then it stopped.
I know I like the Million Dollar Baby comparison a lot, although I feel differently about that movie, and that for me, the shift there in that film feels... I agree with you that I don't quite believe it. And also the point that Clint Eastwood is trying to make, maybe it's just because I don't agree with it, but it also feels more simplistic than this. Whereas the ending of No Country for Old Men, I don't know, I think it's open to a lot of different interpretations. And I think there's a lot of, it repays careful thought, I guess. Whereas Million Dollar Baby seemed to me to be pretty much, okay, that's the point. There it is. I've got it. Now I forget it. Whereas I didn't quite feel that way with No Country for Old Men. The last film I think we're going to talk about today, one that I wanted to talk about just to chat, is it's been out for a month or two already, but that's the Wes Anderson's new film, The Darjeeling Limited. Now, are you a Wes Anderson fan? Have you enjoyed his work over the years, or not so much?
I sure have. I love Bottle Rocket, Rushmore. I like the Royal Tenenbaums a lot. I even enjoyed Life Aquatic, maybe not as much as the others, but I did, and I was looking forward to this.
And your thoughts on this one?
I think that I am losing interest in Wes Anderson. I think it's because
he's repeating himself, or?
Well, there's a moment in Bottle Rocket, his first feature. A girl is flirting with Luke Wilson's character, and she says, "You're really complicated, aren't you?" And he says, with absolute sincerity, "I try not to be." Mm. And I think that at that moment, I think in that film that Wes Anderson was very much aligned with that. I think that he had a fascination with these kinds of characters who complicated their lives, like Dignan in that movie, the Owen Wilson character. But his point of view was with Luke Wilson's character. I'm a simple guy, And I'm interested in these other people, but I'm not one of them. Now I think that he's a serial complicator. I think that he's complicating for complication's sake, and I think that he's very far removed from any sort of real characters. And I think that these hermetically sealed sets of his and the structures that have these sort of muted epiphanies are wearing thin for me.
It's a movie about three brothers and who have been relatively estranged. And Owen Wilson plays the oldest brother, who's also the control freak of them. And he sort of gathered his two brothers together to take this pilgrimage to India, where they're going to find themselves in some way. But of course, nothing goes well. And so the movie's comedy, of which I think there are a lot of laughs in the film, comes out of that. And we sort of know what's going to happen early on, that this is probably not going to go well. But like Life Aquatic and like Royal Tenenbaums and all of his films, that there will be some sense of breakthrough in the end, and we kind of wait for that. I agree that for me, I found this less satisfying, certainly than the first three films. Probably for me, it's about the same as Life Aquatic. In that, it feels like the sort of movie that thinks it's saying something important, and yet I didn't find it to be so. And I found that a bit frustrating. But I must say I did laugh a lot. I think Owen Wilson's really funny, and I think the relationship of the three brothers is fun. But it felt superficial to me in ways that I found frustrating.
Yeah, I agree. I always want to see Owen Wilson in something good like this, because he's become a very famous actor who's in a lot of silly movies, and I think a lot of folks who know him as that actor don't realize that he wrote Rushmore, right, that he wrote Bottle Rocket, that these are really good movies that he had a big responsibility for.
Yep.
And that's nice. But I think I agree with everything that you just said. This movie lacks a Gene Hackman, for example, who's right, sort of putting a big brick through the other guy's window,
yeah, right,
as he says in that movie, you know, something to really shake it up. Things do shake up, but it's sort of, you know, on cue, and it does feels very long. Mm-hmm. And I think what you said about it, trying to say something serious without really being able to, is sort of how I felt about the Coen Brothers movie we were talking about also. And I feel like it shouldn't be wrong for a filmmaker to try to do something great or say something serious. But I want it to be genuine, and I want it to be a real attempt. I don't want it to be a charade. And I think that I don't know what Wes Anderson really thinks or cares about, but I know that when I look at this movie, I very much wanted to feel a connection to the people and their spiritual journey, and didn't.
Yeah.
Instead, we're interested in all the little quirks of their personalities and their complicated lives.
And their complicated luggage.
Yeah, exactly. The objects, the little tokens that his characters in all of his movies carry with them.
Yes, which have, to me, as his movies have gone on, those totems have seemed to be more Wes Anderson's totems than the characters' totems. In other words, you almost get the sense that he's more interested in those things than he is in his characters sometimes.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is frustrating. Whereas, you know, the different things that the characters in the Royal Tenenbaums or Rushmore were obsessed with were really germane to those characters, and at least they felt that way.
Yeah.
So I guess if I might sort of rejoinder on No Country for Old Men, I agree that it's trying to say something big. And one of the things that I like about No Country for Old Men is that it is this very violent movie, and we should say that for anyone who might be going to see it. It's a tough, violent film. And I think that the movie wants to say, okay, if this is the tough, violent world that we live in, what kind of world is that? And I think that's a legitimate response to that theme. Whereas in in Darjeeling Limited, I didn't get the sense that whatever it had to say was in response to anything that's part of the real world.
No, the thing, yeah, the spiritual turning point for these guys is, as far as the movie is concerned, sacrifice of a character we never got to know anyway.
Well, and that the movie could care less about.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I find really frustrating about the film is that it's become a trope in his movies. It's this slow motion tracking camera shot that goes on for a long time. We actually have four of those in this movie. And the first time you see it, it's really cool, in part because it's Bill Murray, and I can watch Bill Murray in almost anything these days. But by the time we get to the third one, it's at the funeral of this character that we don't care about. But it's just this long tracking shot, not of the funeral, but of the three brothers, as if somehow this movie could care so little about this death. It's an excuse for the three brothers dressed in Indian garments to look cool walking across the Indian landscape. I found it really irritating, yeah. Particularly that moment I found irritating.
And that's also sometimes how I feel about movies that want to talk about violence after reveling in it for an hour.
Yeah, I can see that.
Not that I'm not ready to write off the Coen Brothers film just yet, and I think that I could see it again and think about it a little bit more. But I'm totally decided on that part of the Darjeeling Limited. I agree with you there.
Yeah. So.
Okay, hold on. Normally this is the part where the podcast just sort of peters out. You know, this is normally where you grab your iPod and start thumbing around for something else to listen to. But I feel like maybe there's more to say. There used to be this film critic who wrote for The New Yorker named Pauline Kael, and she was a big influence on a lot of people, including me, especially because of her style. She had this really witty, acerbic style, and she wrote with real bite. You know, when she wrote about movies, it was really entertaining to read. I don't think her ideas about movies have stuck with me very much, but her spirit has, you know, that spunk. But she had this one crazy idea that I could just never warm up to, and that was that she would see a movie only once, and seemed to really take pride in this, you know, seeing any movie only once, and then writing 1,000 words for it for The New Yorker, you know. Well, I guess that worked for her, but it seems like, to me, some movies just really require, or at least reward, further thought and consideration. And sometimes that means seeing the movie again. Sometimes that means talking to other people about it, reading about it, just thinking about it, writing about it. You know, as my English teacher used to say, you write to discover what you think. So after our discussion about the Coen Brothers movie, Jay, Robert, and I wondered if maybe round two was in order. So here's what happened this week. I plunked down $10 and saw No Country for Old Men a second time. And Jay Robert, who teaches classes in Chicago, had three of his film critic buddies come in for one of the classes, and they discussed the movie. And I think these experiences sort of brought out some more stuff to talk about. Now, I have to give you a warning about this part of the discussion. Normally, when we're talking about new movies on this podcast, we don't give away the ending. We try not to spoil any of the surprises in the movie, because maybe you haven't had a chance to see it. Of course, when we talk in depth about a movie on this podcast, as we did with Osho Shen's films or Abbas Kiarostami's films, well, then we talk about the entire movie. You know, we don't cut off the bottom 25% of the canvas and pretend like it hasn't affected the composition of the painting, you know? We want to talk about the whole thing. And so for this part of the discussion, we're going to do that. We're going to have plenty of spoilers. So if you have not seen No Country for Old Men and you're planning to, you probably don't want to listen to this yet. I hope you'll come back and find this chapter after you've seen it, and I hope it'll give you some food for thought. But if you haven't seen it, this probably is not the best introduction, because we're going to talk about everything from beginning to end, anything that comes to mind.
We're back, ready for round two.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Hey, Jay Robert. Good.
You had sent an email to me a few days ago saying that you had seen No Country for Old Men a second time, and that the second viewing had kind of confirmed parts of your thoughts from our initial podcast, but that other things had changed. So I was curious what had stayed the same and what had changed.
Well, I guess if I boiled down my criticism from earlier, it was that I felt like this is a violent but enjoyable movie for about an hour, and then it becomes, I think, a bit more serious and introspective about violence, and that that felt like an odd mix. And so I was sort of watching for that again to see if I felt the same way, and there was some kind of interesting things that surfaced. One was when Tommy Lee Jones' character is opening the movie with his voiceover, he's talking about how he loves to hear stories of the old-timers, the old-time sheriffs, and a lot of them didn't even carry guns, as hard as that is to believe, but he loves to hear about that. And there's this kind of a comical moment fairly early in the movie when the sheriff and his deputy are outside Llewellyn Moss's trailer. They notice the lock has been knocked out, and the deputy says, "Should we go in?" And the sheriff says, "With gun out and up." And the deputy pulls his gun out. He moves like he's going to go into the trailer, and he turns just before he does and looks over his shoulder and sees the sheriff still just standing there with his hands on his hips. And he says, "Well, what about yours?" And the sheriff says, "I'm hiding behind you." And everybody laughs. And the funny thing is, I sort of feel that way about the Coens. It's like this movie in a nutshell that it's easy to say that you don't draw your gun and walk into places, and you like even the idea of not having to carry a gun if you're walking behind a guy who's carrying a gun, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
If you're following an hour of violence, I don't know, it just feels kind of funny. This recurs later when we see him entering a motel room and drawing his gun. We know that he's nervous, he's scared, he's alone. And so it's sort of an interesting echo. In fact, there are lots of interesting echoes, I think, in the movie. So that, I think, just sort of fit with what I already thought about the movie. But I was looking for something I'd actually like you to expand on, is that you mentioned last time, and I know we didn't want to give things away, so you didn't elaborate, but you mentioned that you felt like the ending rewarded further thought and reflection.
Yeah, it does. And here we'll move into full spoiler alert, that obviously, what for those people who've seen the film, and don't be listening to this if you haven't seen it, but is you have a movie that is almost going on a straight one-way track, and there's lots of different genre conventions that are produced so that we have certain expectations of what's going to come. We know that there's going to be this showdown between the Josh Brolin character and the Javier Bardem character, and that probably Tommy Lee Jones is going to be in the middle of that. And we know that's going to happen. And then suddenly the story pulls the rug out from under us. And in ways that we don't even realize have happened at first. I mean, I remember in the theater when you get to the motel and all you see are the sort of the police cars around, and you realize that someone has died, and it's like, wait, do we not have the showdown? Do we not have this you know, climactic gun battle that we were expecting? And we don't, and it takes several minutes, I think, for the audience to realize that that's what's happened. And then it's like, well, okay, now where are we going to go? And, well, then the assumption, of course, is that, well, then it's going to be Tommy Lee Jones that's going to have to avenge the death and have the climactic showdown with Javier Bardem. But as the movie continues, I think it becomes clearer and clearer to a thoughtful audience that maybe that's not what we're going to get. And that for me is when the movie really moved into a different level. In that, and when I say that it rewards sort of, you know, thought, sort of consideration afterwards, is that it's a movie, I think, in certain ways about our desire for vengeance, but it's also about this idea of good and evil, I think, and our, you know, sort of a movie or Hollywood idea, or if I might say an old Western idea of good and evil, that, you know, good must confront evil and defeat it. Whereas in No Country for Old Men, we're not going to have that satisfaction. You know, and Tommy Lee Jones, you know, particularly at the very end of the movie, just sort of, you know, gives up and says, I'm not cut out for this. This isn't something I understand, and therefore it's not something that I can confront. And so as the voice of good in this movie, he basically gives up in a way. And I find that to be a really powerful meditation on violence, you know, in the sense that if you've got this movie about violence and then we're expecting, you know, that good will defeat violence with more violence, and yet that's not what we get. And I found that really powerful and really thought provoking. And it's something that I've been thinking about for several weeks since I've seen the film.
Now, I was curious about this sort of way of seeing the movie too. And so I was trying to get in sync with that. And one thing that was interesting to me was, this seems like I'm changing the subject for a second, but I'm not. I'm going to come back. one thing that I remember mentioning before in our previous conversation about this was that, unlike a typical Coen Brothers movie, this movie didn't poke a lot of fun at people from the South, and that we didn't miss those caricatures yep. of Southern people. And I said they weren't there at all, I think. I may have said, well, seen it a second time, they actually are there. They are muted, but every gas station clerk, every motel clerk, every employee is this really stark Southern stereotype of, you know, he almost has to confront each one of them, and they're like symbols of the South. And he's, by he, I mean Javier Bardem, you know, approaches each one of them and gives them a hard time, or they give him a hard time, and it's this sort of comic thing. Probably that reaches.
I was just going to say, but it's not always comic. You know, like particularly with the gas station attendant or the convenience store clerk early on in the film, where Javier Bardem, you know, basically, you know, almost semi tortures him with this idea of the coin flip. That's not comic, would you say?
No, but I do think that the movie takes a certain amount of glee in this torture moment, or this toying with the guy, you know. Maybe not to the point that we would cheer if he were killed, which he isn't. But there's a certain sort of a suspenseful edge to that scene. But I think it reaches a real sort of peak with Llewellyn Moss's wife. Her mother is another one of these, a character who we first hear her on the telephone in the back talking about the cancer, and everyone laughs. And then we actually see her in the back of a cab, and she's going on about how she doesn't need this. You know, he's moving her around and doesn't know why, and they always knew this guy was going to be no good for her daughter, and she has a cancer and doesn't need this. And so it's really silly. And it reminds me a little bit of Flannery O'Connor's story that Good Man Is Hard to Find. Yeah, she's like the grandmother in that a little bit.
Yeah,
but here's what I was looking for. So back to the sort of getting in sync with the way the movie turns is, even as I'm seeing this a second time and I know what's going to happen, I'm seeing this aspect of it that I didn't see quite so clearly before. And this was bugging me a little bit, the way these sort of thumbs stick out, this one being the worst. And then what is the realism that if all of this is sort of Hollywood, or as you said, Western sort of world, or even Coen world, what is the realism that emerges in the end, in the final act? And I think one of them is actually very interesting. It's related to that mother. I forgot about this detail, but she dies. Mm-hmm. And we see even her gravesite. It's almost like a minor thing, but she did die of cancer. It wasn't mm-hmm. it wasn't a joke.
Right.
She wasn't kidding. It was a serious thing, and that leaves her daughter now alone because her husband is gone too. And she sort of has an exchange with Javier Bardem's character also.
Yeah, and that exchange is a real, you know, maybe one of the great scenes in the film is, you know, again, it echoes back to the first confrontation with the convenience clerk over this coin flip, and we know what's going to happen. But the fact that Llewellyn Moss's wife just refuses to play this game, in other words, for her, you know, life is not a coin flip. Life is not this sort of random, you know, bleakness that I think the rest of the film almost embodies. And I think that's really a powerful, incredible scene. I think it's really fantastic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this coin flip business, because you described him in our first discussion as evil personified, which I think is, mm-hmm. if there are two words, those are the two words that sum him up. But what do we know about him? It seems that you know almost nothing. He moves. He is driven to get this money. He's going to get it. But I was looking at the second time. What what is his view of the world? What is his ethic? Because Woody Harrelson's character says that he's a principled man in some ways. He's not swayed by money and, money and fame like you are. He says this to Ellen Moss. You know, he has some certain principles. Well, what are those principles? They are related to randomness. Really into this coin flip business. He mentions that he got here the same way the coin did, or the coin got here the same way that he did, you know, as if he himself is just an agent of randomness, that he's not acting on this. And what sort of morality would that be if it's just it's one actor or another, but it doesn't really matter which?
Yeah, and it goes back to something at the very beginning of the film too, where Tommy Lee Jones, you know, has this thing that he says, I don't want to confront something I can't understand. But certainly Tommy Lee Jones's character can't understand this idea of chance, this idea of randomness, this idea of sort of almost a lack of meaning. And what I find really great about the film is that it's this idea of chance and randomness and the lack of meaning finds its a really great reflection in the form of the film, in that so many Westerns are almost predetermined. You know, we know what's going to happen. If you've seen enough Westerns, you know within the first 20 minutes how it's going to end, or at least what the climactic battle scene at the end will be. And No Country for Old Men sets us up to think that the same thing is going to happen, when of course it does not. I mean, and the rug is pulled out from under us, and then we realize, oh no, we're not in Tommy Lee Jones's world. We're in Javier Bardem's world. And how does it feel to be in Javier Bardem's world? Not so great. You know, this is really a horrible world to be in. And I think that's what's, you know, I don't particularly like movies that just say F you to the audience. And this movie, I think, doesn't a little bit, but I find it really powerful that it says, no, you're not in the world that you thought you were. You are in this world. And how does it feel to be in that world? And I just think that's really amazing.
Well, it's interesting because he's into randomness, but it isn't total meaninglessness. I mean, back to the gas station owner that he's toying with for a while, he discovers that the guy married into this business, and he seems disgusted by that. Doesn't he seem disgusted by that?
Yeah, that's right.
Why? It's the guy lucked into it, as if is what he seems to think. And that just burns him.
Well, and also I think it's that he didn't do anything to gain it. You know, there's one of the things is, you know, that for Javier Bardem's character, it's the sense of who does something belong to? Well, it belongs to the person who takes it. And you know, if you marry into it, you didn't really take it. You just sort of, it was given to you. And I don't think he has any respect for that at all. You know, which is probably why he doesn't have any respect for Josh Brolin sort of, you know, lucking into this money or you know, falling into it. Well, that's, you know, anyone can fall into money. It's whether you take it or not. I think that means a lot more to him.
He seems also, he made this promise to Llewellyn to kill his wife. You know, this is something that is nonsensical to her.
Right.
And what's, you know, that's another thing that he sticks to, you know. It's another part of his ethic.
Right.
He derides Woody Harrelson's rules for living. Yep. And remember, he says, you know, look at your rules and look where they got you. You know, he's standing there with a gun pointed at him. Look where they got you. I don't know what Woody Harrelson's rules are. He doesn't seem all that different, in fact, from Javier Bardem in some ways. But, you know, there are interesting parallels also between Anton and Llewellyn Moss. As you said early on in the movie, and most of the movie, we're set up to side with the good guy Llewellyn. And obviously we don't like, at least we're not supposed to like, you know, Anton, the murderer, the killer, the psychopath. But there are parallels. They both have this sort of, they both buy or take a shirt from someone. They buy a shirt from someone whenever they need one. It's just a weird parallel. And also the scene you were talking about, which is the scene where it takes a surprising turn, when suddenly there are police around this motel. There's someone floating in the pool, dead. The camera moves up to a hotel room, and there, surprise, surprise, is Llewellyn Moss dead, the person we thought we were following. Was this a just before this, he's sort of flirting with a woman by the pool. She's flirting with him, but he's not he's not open to it, but he's not exactly turning away. Do you think this was a compromising situation? It's interesting to think about what was elided here. How is it that he ended up in this motel room, and what happened here? We know Anton found him, but what exactly? I don't know. I don't think I fully believe that he was totally, you know, an innocent necessarily.
Right. Right. No, I think that's right. I'm not sure what to make of that sort of temptation scene. I know when I first saw the movie, my thought was that it was a little bit of a red herring, in that we've seen that kind of scene before, and we're you know, by this point in time, we're really rooting for Josh Brolin's character, you know, because he's got to defeat the forces of evil, but no, don't get tempted by that woman. That would be, you know, particularly in a Hollywood Western, you know, then you become the fallen man, and then you might not succeed in what you're called to do. And so for me, I think it fits within the dynamic that we think the movie is going for, but it turns out, of course, the movie's not going for that at all.
Yeah. Well, somewhat related to that, fairly early in the movie, before we know much about him, Tommy Lee Jones and his deputy have come to the site of the site in the desert where there's the ring of trucks and all the dead bodies. And they've identified Willem Moss already. I can't remember how, maybe from his truck or something. I think it's his truck, actually. And the deputy says, "You figure him to be a drug runner?" And the sheriff says, "Oh, I don't know. Probably not, I guess." There's a certain ambiguity there, but I think that sort of mirrors what we've come to think about this guy, too, is probably not. We don't know him that well yet, but we sort of suspect he may be the good guy we're supposed to side with.
Right.
But I think I still have that same sort of feeling about him, even late as that pool motel scene. Is he the kind of guy who might have cheated on his wife? Oh, I don't know. Probably not, I guess. But I'm not 100% on that.
No, but I think the movie, though, clearly sets him up to be the good guy.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, not just because of the contrast with the bad guys, which, you know, the contrast is stark. But, you know, what really gets him into trouble in the first place is that he decides to take a glass of water back to this dying man in the truck, you know, which is clearly a good act, you know, a selfless act. And that's what, you know, creates all of his problems. He probably, you know, has a chance to get away with this, except that he goes back there at night. And after that, of course, everything he's trying to do is relatively good. He's trying to protect his wife. He's trying to get away and so forth and so on. So, yeah, it's the movie doesn't set him up as, you know, as perfect. He's not Henry Fonda, you know, walking through the desert. But still, he's the good guy in the traditional sense of the movie until it changes there at the end.
Yeah.
I was curious, though, not to completely change the subject, but what are your thoughts on the coin flip scene at the end with Llewellyn Moss's wife, but also then the accident that follows?
Well, the coin flip scene, I think I agree with you that it's a moment where the movie has started to cut through the silliness. We figured out it's not going to go the way we want, the way we wanted it to, the way it seemed like it was going to. And she's sort of summing up, I think, feelings that any reasonable person might have had in this whole thing. This doesn't make any sense. And so that exchange she has with him and sort of cornering him in a way and forcing him to just repeat himself, just call it. You know, he can't justify what he's doing. I think that's pretty interesting.
Yep.
When he's first slammed by that other car and his head is limp against the driver's side window, I think there's a moment where I think this might be the end, his end. He's dead. And this is like an ironic... a poetic justice moment, you know, two on the nose for the Coens. And in fact, it turns out to be two on the nose. He's not done. He's back out on the road. We've seen him invincible. what's the opposite of invincible? He's not an immortal, and he's not invincible. Right. You know, we've seen him having to repair his leg or give himself, you know, pull a bullet out of his knee. Although that sort of makes him a little immortal because he can do that to himself. But he's not, you know, he sort of loses the trail at that point, although he sort of works his way back to it through through chess moves. But here he is, I think, at his weakest, and he's resorted to having to get help from these just two boys who are purely innocently trying to help someone who's in an accident, you know, and he's just going to wander off down the road. I think it's a fairly sublime way to end the movie. What are your thoughts?
It's interesting. I was thinking about the boys. You were talking about how Javier Bardem and Josh Brolin's character are linked. That's another way in which they're linked, because that scene with the two boys helping is very similar to the scene where Josh Brolin is trying to cross the border into Mexico.
Exactly.
And those college guys, you know, he's asking them for help. It's a very similar sequence. excuse me. The thing that I thought about the car accident scene, it was exactly the same way you thought, which is like, oh, well, this is interesting. You know, it's sort of the hand of God sort of comes out and
right.
smashes evil.
Right.
And indeed, that car accident scene is even shot from a God's eye point of view, you know, where we're watching it from above. And then he gets up and he's able to sort of limp away. And I just thought it was really a great, again, not repetition of the theme, but a further elucidation of this theme of what sort of world are we living in, and you know, maybe there is a God in up above, but is he capable of stopping evil? And so it's those sorts of themes and thoughts that I just found really provocative.
For some reason, I also find it interesting, or at least a neat detail that He doesn't want the police to pursue him, and he tells the boys, he gives them $100 and says, I was already gone. I wasn't here. You never saw me. But he doesn't stop there. He doesn't stop with, you never saw me. I was already gone when you got here. He's helping them with their story.
Yeah, that's right.
Because he knows he can concoct this very quickly, but they wouldn't know, you know, they wouldn't know how to do that. They wouldn't have no reason to do that because they're pure.
Right.
Now, what do you make of Tommy Lee Jones's? What do you make of the final minutes of the movie?
This is the part of the movie where I really wish I had seen it twice. And so I think at some point in time in the next month or two, I'll go back and revisit the movie just so I can see the end. Part of it is by that point in the film, I sort of had already locked into this kind of theme, and so for me. My understanding of that is just as a understanding of everything else I've been talking about, which is, you know, that Tommy Lee Jones, because he has that great line, not when he's talking about his dream, but when he's just talking about, he's talking with his brother-in-law, right? Is that
the guy in the wheelchair?
Yeah. Just making sure I've got this straight, but he says, you know, I thought at the end of my life God would come in, and he didn't. And I think that sort of sums up where Tommy Lee Jones is at, is that, you know, he sort of thought that he'd be able to make sense of all of this, and he's kind of confronted by the fact that he cannot. And that's disheartening. That's difficult to deal with. And so I think the dreams are sort of a wish that he could make sense of things, and yet maybe he can't. You know, maybe he can't really go after his father.
And I think he feels aimless and purposeless in the end. You know, he's retired. He's at home. He says, maybe I'll go out riding. You know, he says to his wife, do you want to come with me? And she's like, oh, I'm not retired like some people, you know. And he says, well, maybe I'll just stay and help around the house. And she says, better not. Better not. You know, maybe you should, you know, go ahead and leave me alone. But I think he's just sort of, you know, he's adrift. And the story he tells about his dad, or the dream he has about his dad, is interesting. The comment he makes is that he's older now by 20 years than his dad ever was. I guess his dad died fairly young. So in some sense, his dad is the younger man.
Yeah, that's right.
He's detached from time at this point. You know, he begins talking about the old timers. He's sort of an echo of one of them, you know, in some ways. He's not an old timer, but he's an old timer in his time now. There's a dream of his father where time's sort of crossing, and there's this purposelessness, aimlessness at the end. He's just sort of detached.
Yeah, And again, I apologize if I kind of repeat myself, but it just fits well with, I think, the impact that the movie has. You know, talking with people who aren't film critics, and so many film critics, as you know, Rob, really groove on this kind of film. But regular filmgoers sometimes find it frustrating, and I think in part the film is designed to be a bit frustrating. It's designed to make you think about those kinds of issues and larger ideas and themes. And I think that's one of the best things that a film can do.
I saw the two times I saw this film, it was with a public audience, not a press screening of critics. And they were very different. One was a New York Film Festival audience, and one was just the standard multiplex Saturday afternoon audience. And I was surprised at actually how different they were. It's not entirely surprising, because often at festivals, people are eager to see a really good movie. And so I think they'll sometimes overpraise something because they saw it first. They got to see it before it came out, you know? And so sure. If it was a great movie, they were there, you know? And so it's sort of, you want it to be good. Yep. I think people in the multiplex just want to be entertained. And so they're maybe a bit harder to please. And that's certainly, if I'm reading the audience right. Here's an example. Real early in the movie, Llewellyn Moss is, it's almost like a silent film. There hasn't been very much dialogue, but he's putting this all together. He's seen the circle of trucks out there. He's followed the trail of blood. He sees the guy under the tree, times it for a while. The guy hasn't moved under the tree in quite some time. And so he approaches the tree and he finds a case. He opens the case, looks inside. It's a lot of money. He looks up and he says, "Yeah." And in New York, everybody laughed. In San Francisco, in the multiplex, not a peep. But I think that people were really in sync with it in New York for whatever reason.
Sure.
And we're just it's riveting if you're sort of watching for what is he going to say. It's just sort of a funny thing to say that you know, he knew this was going to be something like this. You know, there is no surprise, but. Also, I did feel that people in San Francisco at the second screening, I don't mean to compare New York and San Francisco or anything like that. It just happened to be these two audiences, whoever they were. But in the San Francisco audience, people, I think, were frustrated in the end. I've sort of got this sense of, that's it, you know?
Yep.
And that's not surprising at all.
No, it's not. No, I think that's a pretty fair reaction. I think if people have seen a lot of film, or at least kind of thought about storytelling in general, once you get past the motel scene, you should an intelligent audience, I think, should start asking themselves, "Oh, I wonder where we're going now," because clearly something has shifted. But I think that's harder for a studio, you know, for a regular audience that doesn't go to a lot of movies or doesn't like to think about the movies they see, and so therefore they just assume that eventually they're going to get back to the place they thought they were going, and then they don't. So I think it's a fair reaction, although a bit of a frustrating one maybe.
Now, I also want to talk about, since it sounds like I have completely turned around and become totally positive on this movie, I acknowledge there are a lot of interesting things going on in this movie, and formally and in many ways, it's very well made. It's very detailed.
I don't think we've mentioned how amazing the cinematography is. Yeah. You know, Roger Deakins' cinematography is truly outstanding and spectacular.
Yeah.
So that at least should be pointed out at some point.
The whole thing is constructed with care. And yet, I was interested to read Jonathan Rosenbaum's review in the Chicago Reader this week, which was one star. Out of four, he's making a point. He would acknowledge, of course, that it's expertly made in some ways, but he has a beef with it that I think is very similar to mine, and that is, I even wrote something similar to in spirit to what he was saying about the movie Monster. Do you remember that with?
Oh sure, with Charlie Theron.
Yeah, which I didn't like at all.
I'm much less excited about that film.
It's not as good a movie as this, but also they have some things in common, which is there are a lot more serial killers in the movies than there are in real life. And it's interesting, I think, that we're fascinated by that. And that's something that Jonathan Rosenbaum shakes his head at and says, this is ridiculous.
Yep.
And I'm troubled by it myself.
And to be honest, Rob, I've written that review before. I mean, not what Jonathan wrote, but I've said, why do we have so many serial killers in movies? You know, and why can't we have regular people? I also have written, like, why do we have so many rich people in movies? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, obscenely rich? Why is that so attractive? And I guess for me, No Country for Old Men, yeah, that's sort of a flaw of the film. But I just think it does so many more interesting things with that kind of genre and character that I'm willing to overlook that. But I agree that if I didn't see another serial killer movie in the next 10 years, that'd be okay.
I also still stand by the feeling that there is a discontinuity here between the sort of two things expressed by this movie. One is that violence is very entertaining. When it's presented well for an hour, but the violence as a part of our society is senseless. I think that's one way to take the ending.
I guess I'm not going to disagree completely with that, except that I knew this was going to be a movie about violence, and I knew there was a serial killer, you know, before I went into it. And so right from the get-go, my antenna was up for that because I don't like stylized violence. I have a real problem with sort of senseless violence in movies. And so I'm always curious how that movie will handle it. And if you remember, you know, the very first scene of violence we have is Javier Bardem killing this deputy. And it's a really gruesome, brutal strangulation. And I don't want to make this sound like I liked that, but I just thought that it didn't feel stylized to me, and it didn't feel like it was, you know, playing that for kicks. I thought there was a real gravity to what was going on, and so therefore, for me, that wasn't. I didn't have that problem with the film. I thought that the way violence was handled was legitimate and not. Not the way it is so often in Hollywood.
Oh, I don't know. I think the way you see him approaching from behind and getting out, people even chuckled in the audience when I saw it, when you see him sort of standing up and stepping out of his handcuffs. And then the way there's the zoom in on his face, that his deranged face, the only time we ever see that face, and the scuff marks on the floor. It feels fairly stylized to me.
Oh, see, I thought there was real power to it.
Not that it isn't powerful. I agree with that, too.
But in a sense, that it's not. It doesn't feel like it's supposed to be hip or cool to me. Yeah. It feels like it's supposed to be awful. And so I guess that's where I don't have a problem.
I think the compressed air thing that he's carrying around is a bit cool. Presented that way, you know, for a while. It's so mysterious. Ooh, what is that thing? It's like it's going to be some crazy torture device. You know, I don't know.
Yeah,
I think
maybe so.
I think that it's like, what do we, you know, I don't know if that probably is from the book, but it's the equivalent of the wood chipper, you know, in Fargo, except that it's far more prominent and far more associated with this character than that was.
Yeah. Yeah. The wood chipper in Fargo, by the way, is the thing that makes me dislike Fargo. So I hear where you're coming from. I just didn't have the same experience this film.
On the other hand, as I mentioned before, I'm conflicted because what I liked about that first hour is the cat and mouse and the logic and the deduction that we as the audience get to, the deductions we get to make. You know, that thing, it may be a cool totem. It may be this icon for this guy that's right. A mystery. But it's also a part of the mystery that the sheriff and deputy are trying to figure out. Like, what do you mean there's no bullet? There was also no exit wound. What does this mean? You know, or how is it that this guy, you know, shoots out locks and yet we don't see a bullet in a wall anywhere? You know, these little details are fun to figure out. So, you know, there you go.
Yep. No, it's, I think it's hard to, particularly in contemporary terms, to make a Western that wasn't really violent. You know, it's, I think if you were to make a Western today that was relatively nonviolent, it would feel really odd. It'd be interesting to see if someone could pull that off, mm-hmm. I don't know what it would feel like. It would be weird.
Now, for some reason, I think I warm up a little more to something like Unforgiven, the Clint Eastwood movie. Now, admittedly, it's been a long time since I've seen that, but there isn't violence in that for a long time. And then there's an explosion of it. It's like Taxi Driver or something, because it's an inevitable part of this world. Even if this guy is trying to stave it off for as long as possible, we know he can't, you know, mm-hmm. which is interesting way to comment on that, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. And with Unforgiven too, you have this sense that I think the audience is genuinely implicated in that film, where we desperately want this violence to happen. You know, we want, the bad guy to get his comeuppance and not mildly, you know, violently. And then when it comes, like, oh, is that what I really wanted? Did I want it to be that much?
Yeah.
I think Clint Eastwood really explored that in interesting ways.
Yeah. I didn't want it to be defeat for the guy I was rooting for, you know, but it was.
No.
Hey, Robin, J. Robert, this is Neil in Dallas, and I just finished listening to your podcast on Hosh Hashem's Three Times and was thinking, while you were talking about movies that were circling back on themes that great filmmakers had dealt with before, and whether that enriched your perspective on them or somehow was a slighter version of a better thing that had come before. And I was thinking about Kiarostami's The Wind Will Carry Us, and remember watching that the first time at the Music Box Theater in Chicago and just being really blown away by it. I'd seen a number of his movies before, and including Homework, which you guys talked about, and at least two-thirds of the trilogy that starts with Where's the Friend's House, and just really being amazed by the way that that movie brought together things that looked familiar from previous films, but put them in a new context that seem really rich to me. But I remember walking out of that film thinking it was one of the best movies I saw that year, but that I wouldn't know whether it was anything that somebody who'd never seen a Kiarostami film before would appreciate in the same way. Would it be inaccessible to them for being, you know, unfamiliar, that they didn't have the background with the movie, or would it be extremely rich because they were coming to it for the first time? And I don't know that I've ever talked with anybody for whom that was the first film that they saw. Really enjoy your podcast and the exchange that you guys have with one another. It's definitely different than anything else that I'm used to hearing, and appreciate your taking the time to put it together.
Well, thank you, Neil from Dallas. First of all, those are very kind words, and I couldn't agree with you more about Abbas Kiarostami. He's almost a prototypical example of a filmmaker who circles back on stuff that he's done and reshapes it, finds new things in it. I'm surprised we didn't think to mention him ourselves, since we've mentioned him on, you know, every other podcast. But no, you're definitely right, and I agree with you that I'm not sure what someone would think if they came to Life and Nothing More or Through the Olive Trees and hadn't seen Where's the Friend's House. I don't know, but if you've seen him, it's pretty cool. In fact, I think the middle one of that trilogy may be my favorite Kiarostami movie at this point. If you have comments about this podcast, give us a call at 415-287-4020 or leave a comment on the web at erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. Or send us email, feedback@erratamag.com. And in particular, this time, we would like to hear from people who listen to other film-related podcasts. Let us know what else is out there. What else do you like to listen to? We'd love to hear it. On the next Errata Movie Podcast, I'll tell you about some of the movies I saw in New York at the New York Film Festival. And we'll do a speed round to talk about a bunch of the movies that are coming out just as the year ends. And we have a couple of year-end interviews in the queue. That's next time.